Welcome to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene. Daily, we bring you insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. Find Bloomberg Surveillance on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Bloomberg. William Dudley is the former New York Fed president, now Princeton Holding Court as a senior research scholar. But far more than that, he developed Goldman Sachs economics pre-Jan Hatzius with Ed McKelvey and knew that it was about theory, it was about the guesstimates, but it was also the granularity of the data. Bill Dudley joins us this morning. Dr. Dudley, I want to go right to the Dudley. It feels like an Ed McKelvey call here. I want to talk about the Dudley Beige Book, about how you use data like Mike McKee just reported.
Well, you have to look at the data in the context of what's going on elsewhere. So, you know, the fact that the retail sales were a little weaker in October reinforces the idea that as the pandemic gets worse and there's more shutdowns and restrictions, that the November data, which we haven't gotten yet, will be even softer. So, you know, we have a valley that we have to go through over the next 6 to 9 months before the vaccines arrive and we can get people vaccinated. And I think it's going to be a difficult valley to go through because the pandemic's getting worse. And there's no fiscal stimulus package that seems to be about to arrive in a timely way.
This is so, so important, folks, and why it's so good to have William Dudley with us right now. The only one I can think of, Bill Dudley, is Lawrence Meyer in terms of looking at the granularity of the data week to week, as you did years ago at Goldman Sachs. What data are you looking for forward to frame out the next two quarters?
I think I'm going to be focused mostly on the course of the pandemic itself and the reaction of state and local governments in terms of the restrictions that they put in place and how much people actually social distance. You know, to the extent that the pandemic worsens and we have more restrictions, that's going to exert downward pressure on the economic data. And I think it's also important to recognize that when we get data like what we got today in retail sales, we're really looking in the rearview mirror. I mean, this data is October data, first half of October data. We're in a much worse place today than we were in the first half of October.
This, Bill, as you point out, is about momentum. Momentum is fading. The data, as you anticipate, is set to worsen from here because of the restrictions. Let's talk about where this leaves policymakers, specifically monetary policymakers at the moment. You wrote an op-ed piece for Bloomberg Opinion in the last month, which said quite clearly that you think, and many others share this view, that they have run out of ammunition. So, Bill, where does it leave them right now?
Well, they can do more. I mean, they haven't completely run out of ammunition in the sense that they could increase their asset purchases or they could extend the duration of the asset purchases that they make. But it just wouldn't have that much consequence because the Fed has actually succeeded in what in terms of what it wanted to accomplish. It's made interest rates very low and it's made financial conditions very accommodative. The Fed did more. Would it help? A little bit. But at the end of the day, this is really about fiscal stimulus and providing support to incomes to help people get through the valley that we face in the months ahead.
On balance, Bill, as a former policymaker at the Fed, when you look at things right now, we have market participants come on this program all day, every day, 5 days a week, talking about risk or lack thereof in the credit market because of the Fed's presence in it. Is that a good thing at a time like this?
Well, I think the Fed's backstops are pretty important because it basically reassures people that there is a buyer of last resort. And so that encourages other people to be engaging in financial markets. The Fed's, you know, the liquidity facilities that the Fed's has provided actually haven't had that great amount of takedown. What's happened is that they've served as effective backstops. And I think it's you know, very, very appropriate. Another issue that's going to get some attention is whether the Fed's going to extend the date of when these liquidity facilities lapse. Right now, they're scheduled to end at the end of December, and I think it's very likely that they'll extend them probably through at least into end of March and maybe through the first half of 2021.
Bill, a lot of people agree that the Fed stepped in and provided a backstop to a lot of companies in a good way. But there's some concern that the Fed is dramatically exacerbating inequalities, not just in terms of households, but among companies as well, because right now we're seeing the pain really being felt at smaller companies that don't even register with their bankruptcies since they simply just close up shop and they don't have access to borrowing money in credit markets in the same kind of way. Do you think that the Fed has almost whitewashed some of the pain with their policies, looking at broader markets that have this enthusiasm, and that this is somehow at this point potentially even harmful?
Well, I don't think it's harmful. I mean, in the sense that it's much better to have financial markets operating than not operating. I think the problem for the Fed is that monetary policy is a blunt instrument, which can't really do much about the fact that the impact of the pandemic falls very unequally on household and on the different types of businesses. You know, the Fed introduced the Main Street Lending Program to try to get to a set of businesses that can access the capital markets very easily. And it just hasn't worked very well because there's lots of terms and conditions. And so there's been very little take up. You know, I think it's much better for the Fed to generate as strong economy as they can, and recognizing that there may be unequal burdens, but then that's for Congress and the administration to come forward with a fiscal package that supports those that are most disadvantaged by what's happened.
Meanwhile, next month, the Fed is expected by some, including J.P. Morgan, to extend the duration of their asset purchases. Do you think that based on where we are, based on what markets are doing, that they should go through with that and that they should make that decision next month, even if market conditions are similar to where they are today?
Well, I don't think there's a tremendous rush that they have to do it in December. If they waited, I don't think there'd be a great consequence with 10-year Treasury note yields below 1%. But it sort of makes sense, right? If you're buying treasuries and agency mortgage-backed securities now, not so much to support market function, but to keep long-term rates low, then why not concentrate your purchases in the long end of the market?
Dr. Dudley, I must ask you about governor-to-be. It's a very close vote right now, Judy Shelton. I want you to explain to our audience what her theory is grounded in traditional economics. If it's not classical or neoclassical, if it's not Keynesian, what is Shelton theory as you perceive it?
Well, I don't think I understand her theory, to be very blunt about it. Look, I think it's unfortunate that the Congress is Republican Congress is pushing forward to confirm Shelton and Waller. I think it would make more sense to leave those positions open so that Joe Biden could put his imprint on the Fed. End of the day, though, if Shelton were to get confirmed, I don't think it would make a huge difference in terms of how the Federal Reserve sets policy.
Bill, I must ask you, and this is so important, if you don't understand her theory, do you perceive that she's coming from some convolution of Austrian economics and a traditional historical German economics, literally from another time and place?
Well, she's been inconsistent over time, right? On one hand, she espouses sort of gold standard hard money. On the other hand, she now wants to, you know, interest rates extraordinarily low, even before we entered the pandemic. So she seems to bend with the political winds, and you really want the Fed to not bend with the political winds. You want them to be independent of the political pressures.
Well, Bill, let's talk about process and just wrap things up there. I've lost count of how many meetings you must have been to at the Federal Reserve. If there was someone with a more unorthodox approach to monetary policy and policy setting, how loud could that voice possibly be if she was confirmed?
Not very loud. I mean, the way the Federal Reserve works, it's a consensus. It's a committee. The chairman sets the agenda. If you're, if you have views that are not shared by others on the committee, you can dissent, but you're not going to have any meaningful impact on policy. I think, you know, if Shelton is confirmed, I mean, the main implication of it is just that Biden wouldn't have a chance to appoint governors to the Fed, and that might slow down his ability to put people in place that he thinks are more consistent with his policy views, not so much on monetary policy, but in terms of financial regulation and bank regulation.
Bill, great to catch up. We appreciate how open you've been in the last 10 minutes. Bill Dudley there, former New York Fed president, now at Princeton and Bloomberg Opinion columnist. Joining us now, Mona Mahajan, Allianz's Global Investors U.S. Investment Strategist. Mona, Kit Jukes of Soc Gen said this morning, understandable the last week or so in this market, but unsustainable. Do you share that?
I actually think that the rotation part of this equity move is somewhat sustainable. So, you know, we see, of course, in the next few months, we may get some volatility. We're still not through the toughest part of this virus and this pandemic. But beyond that, you know, I think the incremental news we got this week and last week was not only vaccines, but vaccines that were over 90% effective, or 90 and 95% effective. You know, even the scientists in their wildest hopes were not expecting two vaccines that would produce that. So in our mind, that's incremental news that could get us through this pandemic in the next 12-month period. And so for us, when you think about 2021, where growth may start to reaccelerate because you have a true reopening, not only in the US, but globally, rates will probably remain low at least through 2021. And you have the potential for fiscal stimulus and maybe some fiscal spending. You know, that's not a bad backdrop for risk assets broadly. So overall, we continue to feel that if you have some periods of volatility, use that tactically. If you haven't already layered in some cyclicality, some non-US assets, start to think about that.
Mona, Walmart's breaking out to a new high. Are corporations going to adjust to all this? I mean, the bears are there. John's mentioning the gloom of Abramowitz, the gloom of SocGen and the rest of them as well. Mona, I just as simple as I can, are we underestimating the ability of corporations to adapt to this pandemic?
You know, clearly this pandemic has accelerated some key trends. So we've seen brick and mortar to online retail, and Walmart's a clear beneficiary of that. They've accelerated their online programs. But also things like, you know, a more work from home employee base, that's been accelerated through this. We think that's here to stay to some extent, supports cloud computing, supports cybersecurity, going from, you know, medical visits in person to telemedicine, you know, another trend that's probably here to stay. So there are several trends that we are seeing that, that corporations probably had been thinking about, but now really have to get on the ball. These trends have been accelerated through this pandemic and are likely here to stay to some extent. And so that's why we still think a balance is important. You know, some of these quote unquote stay at home stocks are actually, you know, they have 3, 5, 10 year secular growth trends behind them. And so it's important to have that part of the exposure as well. But, you know, we could see a few months at least of really strong outperformance from the cyclical part of the market as well.
Mona, one of the hardest aspects of this moment is there's the near term, as John was talking about, that's looking darker and darker, and frankly, darker than a lot of people had expected with respect to the pandemic's trends. And then you have the longer term, or the even intermediate term, which looks better than expected given the efficacy of some of these vaccines. You said in periods of volatility to take advantage and go long into the trades that you're talking about. What counts as volatility? What's the entry point that you're looking for?
Yeah, it's a great question because in some cases, and certainly since the start of this quarter, we haven't gotten many pullbacks. In fact, the S&P is up 7.5 or 8% since September 30th, and some of the cyclical sectors are up 13, 14, 17%. So we haven't quite seen a dip to buy quite yet. We do think over the next, you know, 2 month period through year end, you're not going to get a continuation of this straight upward movement. There will be pullbacks. Keep in mind, in any given year, 3 to 5 pullbacks in a 5 to 10% basis or 5 to 10% range are normal and are probably healthy. If we go through another period like that, certainly ahead of 2021, I think it's important to start thinking about how you want to position as these vaccines get rolled out, as hopefully we start to see this change and shift in consumer behavior, perhaps a little bit back to pre-pandemic activity levels. And so we do think we'll get a period of consolidation that can be used to position yourself accordingly. So it's important to watch for that.
Mona, to what extent do you think that people were conditioned by the price action of the spring and conditioned to look through what's playing out in America right now? And I wonder what you think the fallout of that actually is.
Yeah, it's a great question because clearly when the Fed stepped in March and they stepped in a big way, not only bringing rates back down to the lower bound, adding QE, adding these credit facility programs that really supported the functioning of credit and equity markets, they really did put a bit of a backstop into this market. And so it does feel like markets are conditioned to buy that dip. What we'd say is it's important to stay a little bit active in how you buy these dips and how you position yourself in the marketplace. If you want to have performance that's in line with, you know, the broader indices, you do need to think about your weighting in certain sectors, in certain regions, et cetera. And so there is a bit of conditioning, but we think it could be more than just buying the overall market. It's how you position as you move forward. But as long as the Fed is there, as long as global central banks are in play, we think there is a bit of a backstop in the market. And that's to some extent helpful, but longer term, we'll see what the consequences are.
Mona, great to catch up. The Fed is there.
Thank you, guys.
With or without Judy Shouter, Mona Mahajan from Allianz Global Investors. Thank you.
Let's get started here. Right now on Amazon, Tom Forte with us with D.A. Davidson. He writes brilliant, brilliant notes. Yeah, he's a bull on Amazon, but this, of course, on this big announcement today. Tom, I get the type, too, that this is about hurting Rite Aid, hurting CVS, taking market share away, et cetera. What's in it for Mr. Bezos?
So those are the implications to the competition. This is a large trillion-dollar global opportunity for Amazon. So Amazon needs these large global trillion-dollar opportunities to sustain their growth and their multiple. So my question for Amazon is, what took you so long? But I think this is a great move by Amazon.
Okay, so it's there. And you know, I look at Amazon right now. Does this move the needle on their revenues? I mean, is it a five-year project?
Excellent question, Tom. Collectively, I would say Amazon's healthcare efforts are needle movers. So you think about how they've kind of been forced into healthcare, testing their employees for COVID, opening these mini clinics for their employees' families, and now they're advancing their pharmacy efforts. They had PillPack. Now they're going to open an online pharmacy. I think collectively their efforts in healthcare are needle movers.
Well, Tom, let's walk through things just quickly. The acquisition of PillPack, how does it fit into all of this? And do you think they can do this from where they are now organically?
Complementary to the extent you think of PillPack as making it easier for consumers to follow their prescriptions. I still believe that over time they're going to have physical pharmacies that will complement their online ones. I really thought when they acquired Whole Foods in 2017 they would devote a portion of that box to a pharmacy. So I still think this is only the beginning, but an important move for Amazon given the large total addressable market.
Tom, their Whole Foods acquisition and rollout hasn't necessarily been incredibly profitable. We don't necessarily know. They don't break out all of the data, but their forays into physical grocery stores in the past have not been as successful. Why is this time different? Why are we seeing the shares of CVS and Walgreens plummet on this news?
So, excellent points. Historically, Bezos has said, your sales is my opportunity. I feel like historically Walmart said your gross profit's my opportunity, and Walmart went hard into generic drugs, if you remember. So there is a lot of profitability opportunity for Amazon, especially in generics. Grocery, though, is not a high-margin category. So I would say that expectations of Whole Foods generating materially higher margins were overly optimistic. The case for pharmacy is different, though.
Tom, there is a broader question, especially as Democrats have more power heading into 2021 with Joe Biden taking the role of president. There is a question of how much more antitrust concern this raises about Amazon, the fact that they're plowing into every aspect of people's lives. Does this matter if it's done organically? Does this put pressure to possibly break them up or restrain them in some capacity?
So I think that it's bipartisan support to restrain the impact of Amazon, Apple, Facebook, and Google, but I think both parties are trying to figure out how to do that. It's my understanding at one point Elizabeth Warren proposed legislation to limit acquisitions over $1 billion, so you'll see a lot of smaller acquisitions if that happens, and to your point, more companies building it organically. From an anti-competitive standpoint, though, it's hard for me to imagine that they could prove this is bad for the consumer and that this raises costs in pharmacy.
You know, I'm looking at the margins on Rite Aid, and come on, it's like a grocery store margin as well. Tom, give us a percentage margin we should see there. Forget about the cloud for now. What do they make on all the cardboard boxes on margin? What are they going to make on pharmacy as related to that and related to the razor-thin margins at Whole Foods?
Yep, so collectively, I think of Amazon as having the potential for a 20% adjusted EBITDA margin long-term. If I put most profitable, least profitable, it'd be advertising first, then cloud, then pharmacy, then third-party retail, and then dot, 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 a huge...
No, but come on, give me a number. Stop. Tom, give me a number here. I get the 20% EBITDA. What's the cardboard box margin, and what's pharmacy going to bring?
Sure. Pharmacy, I think, confidently will bring more than a 10% adjusted EBITDA margin, and the first-party retail margin is flat.
Tom, great to catch up. Appreciate your time today, sir. Tom Forte there, D.A. Davidson, Senior Research Analyst.
With us right now, this is, folks, it's such a blur here. I really don't know what the schedule is. We've got such a great team that just throws it at me. And this is a joy. Ian Bremmer joins with Eurasia Group. G-Zero Media. He's been ensconced, sequestered away, working on a new book. How many times, Ian, have you changed your book in the last 6 weeks, given the news flow?
Not at all, my friend. Not at all. I mean, you know, these are, when you're doing a book, if it can't stand up, you're not doing a book.
So many things to talk about. Let's just start with the bigger and the broader. Fareed Zakaria talks about a post-American world. What does a post-Trump world look like?
Well, it's going to be a honeymoon. There's no question that most leaders, not all, but most leaders around the world are going to be very happy to see the back of Trump. And so the big summits that happen will appear much more consensus-oriented. There'll be a honeymoon. They'll want to give Biden some small wins to show that the United States is back. But you and I both know that the reasons that we have so much uncertainty in the global order have comparatively little to do with Trump. They're structural. They're, you know, a United States that is less in leading from the front. You remember leading from behind. That started with Obama-Biden. You have Europe, which is more divided post-Brexit. You have Russia, which is in decline and undermining the United States and our friends. And then you have China, which is not aligning towards the U.S.
Right.
in political and economic systems at all. None of those things change one bit with the Biden administration.
Okay, but the tone changes. And I think all of our listeners, you know, worldwide and whatever their politics is, they overweight, they underweight tone. Dr. Bremer, you've been doing this for a while. Tone, we've learned, matters. What's the proper tone in the first weeks of a Biden administration as they rebuild state?
That we care about values, that democracy matters, human rights matter.
Well, does he get on an airplane? I mean, is the big surprise here, is Joe Biden's going to do a international tour as president?
No, I don't think so, because he's entering governance with a very dysfunctional transition in the midst of an incredibly challenging coronavirus at home. And he needs to respond to that at home. I mean, there's no question that there will be a lot of wins just by undoing stuff that Trump has done. So he rejoins Paris Climate Accord 76 days after the U.S. left. He tries to get the United States back in the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Agreement with the Russians. I mean, you know, you've got a whole bunch of stuff like that. I mean, even the World Health Organization and announcing that the U.S. will participate in COVAX for vaccine development and distribution. It's not a game changer. But if you want to talk about tone, all of those are things that show that the United States doesn't want to surprise its allies, wants to be constructive in working with other countries around the world.
So, Ian, we just finished up a, you know, very contentious election. Now we have a transition that is not transitioning. How are our adversaries around the world viewing the U.S. right now as we try to transition from one administration, one government to the next?
I think governments are transitioning pretty capably. So you look at a country, there are countries that really are very upset that Trump is gone. You look at Brazil, and given Bolsonaro's views on climate and the Amazon and the fact that Biden will be a polar opposite, this is a real problem for him. There's likely to be difficulties with trade, agriculture, you name it, on the back of that. And yet, it's not going to affect his popularity at home or his likelihood of being reelected one bit. And I think that's the real point. Yes, you want to prepare to have a better relationship with Biden for most of the countries around the world. But overwhelmingly, the United States is not driving outcomes for a lot of these conflicts. It's a much more multilateral and a much more G-zero global environment. And I think that what we're seeing is a lot of hedging. I mean, I had this debate yesterday with Neil Ferguson, and he was saying we're in a Cold War. And one of the strongest reasons why we're not in a Cold War is because most other countries in the world outside of the United States and China have no interest whatsoever in picking sides like that. They're all hedging. And that's an important thing to keep in mind when you think about the post-U.S. transition.
Ian, will our allies and the world leaders in general embrace the U.S. under the Biden administration after the last 4 years, where it really was President Trump's strategy of America first, and we really burned a lot of bridges?
Well, I mean, how many bridges did we burn, right? I mean, we definitely jumped on the bridges a lot and showed petulance. You look at NATO. No, I mean, the actual NATO policy, NATO is pretty much as strong today as it was 4 years ago. The U.S., Trump pushed for countries to spend more money. The U.S. spent more on defense. You've got forward deployments in Poland. You've got rotating deployments in the Baltic states. Nothing happened at IMF, the United Nations. The U.S. paid its dues, and the IMF has had a pretty good year because so much money has been required for countries that are in tough shape on the back of coronavirus. Trump didn't kill that. So, look, there are a lot of leaders around the world that find that Trump, a meeting with Trump was an exercise in walking on eggshells, that you never knew what bomb he was going to throw. Was he going to say he was going to pull out troops, or was he going to whack you with tariffs, or tell the Japanese suddenly, hey, I just called the North Korean leader. What do you think about that? I mean, you know, they didn't like that. So, again, I think that they will try to give Biden some early wins. They won't be big, but they'll show that we're so much happier with this guy. The real issue is that the United States is not providing the kind of leadership on trade, on global security, and certainly on the promotion of democracy that many other leaders would like it to. And that's much deeper than Trump or Biden or Obama. That's been going on for a long time.
Ian Bremmer with us. We continue. Dr. Bremmer, of course, with Eurasia Group. And I can tell you, I've already had some inquiries. Yes, we are planning. We're in intense negotiations, multilateral negotiations with Eurasia Group to do their wonderful and important kickoff to the beginning of the year. Always important themes and scary prescient from the Eurasia Group team. Ian, your thoughts on a not TPP, but a China PP trade agreement. There was a great map out in the zeitgeist of China and the Pacific Rim, even down to New Zealand. And then there was like what TPP was going to be. And it's like, not that. And there's this big gray spot called the United States of America not participating in any of this. Define the vacuum by our absence in multilateral trade agreements in the Pacific.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of like one more Belt and Road. I mean, you and I have talked about that for years. The Chinese are out there building lots of infrastructure. The United States, the companies are, but the government is not. And that aligns these countries more with China. The Chinese drive a big multilateral trade agreement. It's not a massive shift in terms of tariff reduction. It's not a high standard agreement like the Trans-Pacific Partnership would have been. And it's certainly not exclusive. It doesn't stop these countries from trading with the United States, just as when the Chinese build a port through Belt and Road, it doesn't stop the United States companies from using that port. It drives more wealth. We like that. A world with a China-driven RCEP deal is a world of higher economic growth. It's better than a world without it. But you and I would both much rather if the United States was doing more of the driving, and we're not interested. Let's remember that the Trans-Pacific Partnership was initially tried under Obama-Biden. They failed. And then Trump killed it, and now Biden's going to be president, and he's not going to raise it again because the Democratic Party wouldn't support it, not the Democratic Party of 2021. So the fact that China now is the leading trade partner in the world with over 130 countries, the fact that China is about two-thirds the size of the economy of the U.S., at its peak, the Soviet Union was less than 40%. I mean, it's a much more robust economic competitor. And unlike the United States, the Chinese government is actually driving strategy. I mean, we've got a lot of corporations that drive strategy, but our government, you know, we have elections that last for 2 years every four, and the U.S. is right now the most politically divided country by far among the advanced industrial democracies. It makes it harder for us to get this stuff done.
Well, we're out of time. 10 seconds, Ian. When do we see your next book?
Probably late spring.
Of what, 2023,
2024? Yeah, you know, I mean, we're getting there, man. We're getting there.
Ian Bremmer, thank you so much. Greatly appreciate it. They are beautiful books. They're almost like folks' chapters, like Patrick O'Brien. They're like chapters of books across the span, like a 200, 300-page chapter. Looking forward to that from Dr. Bremmer. Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. Subscribe and listen to interviews on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, or whichever podcast platform you prefer.
I'm on Twitter at Tom Keen. Before the podcast, you can always catch us worldwide on Bloomberg Radio.